You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wai Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. Fi Akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with Yaks Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the new school subjects set to be implemented into the new proposed curriculum and the drastic changes to art history and outdoor education. And I also spoke to the Children's Commissioner, Dr. Claire Ahmed, about the temporary pause of international adoptions and what this means for children overseas. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with the University of Otago's Robert Patman about international support for Palestinian statehood and whether or not Foreign Minister Winston Peters will follow his Australian and Canadian counterparts. I also spoke with the University of Auckland's Helen Petusis-Harris about the CDC reviewing vaccine recommendations and regulations under an anti-vax committee.
Here are Hofakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuka patuhi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wa e wareware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakurongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te apai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government has announced some new secondary school subjects and changes to current ones, which will be a part of the proposed new curriculum. Some of these subjects include earth and space sciences, civics, politics and philosophy, media journalism and communications, and Te Mātai I Te Ao Māori. However, art history as a subject is set to be axed, instead being integrated into other visual arts subjects such as design, painting and photography. In addition to this, outdoor education as a subject is set to become fully vocational. Those in these sectors have criticised these moves, with Auckland Art Gallery's Head of Curatorial and Exhibitions, Sarah Farrier, saying the move will close doors for young people, with Claire Amos, a principal at Albany Senior High School, saying that making outdoor education vocational will result in a loss of funding for the subject. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about these topics. Why are we seeing these subjects added to the new proposed curriculum?
Well, what employers, what students and what parents have told the government is that they want the NCEA to deliver a really rich body of knowledge which is assessed in the right direction, because if New Zealand's going to be a high-income country and a high-performing country in the 21st century, I mean, there's only 5 million of us, so we've got to be really good at stuff. It's got to have the policies in place when it comes to education to transfer really useful and important knowledge from one generation to the next. And it's these pathways that are going to shift New Zealand from where we are now, which is kind of muddling along and everybody not really being that satisfied with where we've got to a high-performing economy.
Another subject we could see implemented into the proposed curriculum is a generative AI subject for Year 13 students. Would you expect with this course that the subject will also look at maybe the negative aspects of AI, such as its impact on the environment, some of AI's ethical concerns, such as data privacy, and its potential impact of reducing jobs?
Well, I think those are all really important matters to consider when looking at the benefits of a technology like AI. I mean, sure, losing jobs. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, we probably still had people making carts for wagons, but, you know, we had the motor car and we've got all kinds of other a technology that allows us to have personal mobility and mass rapid transit, so we're not so much relying on people making wagon wheels anymore. This is a progression in terms of human evolution and our society and economy. But I think it's really important that young people at school understand what is the potential, what are the opportunities for this type of technology, how they can apply it to their learning, but also to their future employment, and even the common things that they might want to do, like where should we go on holiday? Where should we stay given our budget? If you can ask AI, or some type of online tool, questions like that, it's really going to help improve our everyday lives.
Some current subjects, such as art history and outdoor education, are seeing drastic changes with this proposal. Art history is set to be cut, with outdoor education set to become fully vocational. Why are we seeing these changes in this space?
When it comes to art history, it's going to be incorporated into other subjects like visual arts and classics, because we want to assure that when students are taking courses, it's actually setting them up for a career. There's only so many art history roles, and students wanting to pursue this further can certainly do that at university. But for students who choose not to study art or art history at university, then the changes to NCEA will ensure that there's more resources and more availability for the robust education when it comes to mathematics, English and science that sets them up for further study and employment. And, the same applies to outdoor education. It's going to continue to be a subject that students can study through unit standards, through vocational standards. But if you think about people who want to pursue an outdoor education career that involves marine science or working in the environment, those skills are still going to be primarily driven by understanding of mathematics, science, biology, for example, and English. The outdoor education component is something that can be added as a vocational unit.
Previously, several agriculture-based subjects were set to become fully vocational. However, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon says the reversal on this decision follows feedback from the sector. Now, we've seen 25 leading art galleries sign an open letter to the government regarding the cutting of art history in the new curriculum, with the organisation Education Outdoors NZ, or EONZ, also launching a petition to Education Minister Erica Stanford. Should we expect the government to rethink these changes, maybe?
Well, I think the minister is going to have a lot of feedback, and that's the whole point of consulting on the NCEA future, to understand what is important and why. But it does need to be balanced against the objectives of the education system, which is to produce high-performing graduates who can either go straight into work or onto vocational education and training, trades training, or into an academic pathway. And if we're mushing all this stuff together at school in terms of NCEA, and people are able to get credits for things that apparently lead them on to, apparently qualify them for university education, university entrance and higher education, but don't involve the transfer of important core skills like mathematics, science and English, then we're actually not doing them a service, and we're just making it much harder for them once they do, if they do go on to university, having to go back and study foundational subjects when they really should be in their first and second years, just putting the foot down and getting on with taking on more high-level information.
The government wants to improve the number of students actively attending school, but could these changes to art history and outdoor education, for example, result in students losing incentive to attend school if these subjects that they enjoy so much aren't included in the new curriculum?
Well, look, they'll still be able to pursue these subjects as unit standards, right? So it just won't be part of NCEA. But you're absolutely right. I mean, schools have to be focused on what students want to learn and how they want to learn. And that's one of the reasons that the government is focused on standing up charter schools. A number of state schools have expressed interest and some are already applying to enter that system. Charter schools give the opportunity for schools to set not just deliver the curriculum, the mandatory curriculum, but do it in a way that really allows young people to learn in their best possible environment. The Forest School is a primary school in Warkworth that's a charter school that's going to allow kids to learn all of the basics including while they are forest and beach exploring and spending time with animals and gardening. This will really complement their learning of core subjects like reading, writing and maths by adding variation to their school day and week. That's great at primary school, but I think by the time you get to NCA, we have to be very, very focused on the fact that we're preparing people for university entrance, trades training, and getting into the workforce with really important skills and knowledge. So that's the purpose of the changes to the system.
Now, linking back to the new subjects set to be introduced in the new curriculum, when can we expect more detail into what these subjects specifically entail?
So look, when we're thinking about what is the curriculum that's going to be delivered with each subject, I understand that's under development, but Minister Stanford will have more to say about that as we get through this consultation period. I'm sure that the feedback that she is receiving and that officials are receiving will feed into a much improved curriculum for these new subjects.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the changes to secondary school subjects in the proposed new curriculum.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
Foreign Minister Winston Peters is headed to New York for a conference on the two-state solution in the Middle East, where debate over Palestinian recognition and statehood will take place during the 80th session of the UN General Assembly. As countries like Australia and Canada pledge support for Palestinian statehood, alongside other countries that have either expressed intent or already done so, Peters has remained closed off as to whether or not New Zealand will join these ranks. I spoke to the Professor of International Relations at the University of Otago, Robert Patman, about what these expressions of support for Palestinian solidarity mean in the long run and what we can and should expect from Peters and the government in this regard. What does the support of countries like Australia and Canada mean for Palestinian statehood?
I think it's very important. Initially, it's symbolic. Remember that the majority of countries in the UN, out of 193, there's at least 142 prior to these recent bout of recognitions, or series of recognitions, I should say, which have added to the total. So we now have Britain, Australia, Canada, as well as Portugal, about to extend recognition. It is significant because while the vast majority of countries already recognise the prospect of a Palestinian state, most liberal democracies have been waiting for the United States to lead on this issue. But the United States has changed its position from the Biden administration to the second Trump administration. The second Trump administration has fallen in basically behind the Netanyahu position, which has been longstanding, which does not recognize any prospect of political self-determination for the Palestinians. Indeed, the current Israeli government has indicated it will annex the West Bank, where 4 million Palestinians live, and take full control of Gaza, and has also indicated, with encouragement from the United States, that it will welcome the prospect of Palestinians leaving Gaza, which I think is diplomatic speak for saying they're going to try to evict them.
I mean, in terms of that US support for Israel, what are we likely to see from this growing support for Palestinian statehood? Is that going to have any real effect?
Well, it's a tough situation because Israel depicts this as rewarding terrorism, that by countries like Britain, Australia and Canada, by recognising a Palestinian state, they say they're rewarding Hamas terrorism. I think that's wrong. I think what these countries are doing is signifying disapproval of Netanyahu's government's refusal to acknowledge the Palestinian right of political self-determination. And there is a practical concern here. While the step is symbolic, it has practical implications. That is to say, if we wait till Hamas is defeated, by that time, many countries believe that Israel would be in full possession of the disputed territories, and therefore there'd be no actual geographical space for a Palestinian state, given the publicly expressed intentions of Netanyahu. Netanyahu has never wanted a Palestinian state. he broke with the Oslo Accord back in the early 90s. And since the mid-90s has basically campaigned against a Palestinian state. And it's kind of ironic he accusing Western countries of rewarding Hamas, because up until shortly before the appalling terrorist attack by Hamas on Israel in October 2023, Netanyahu had tacitly supported Hamas, encouraged Qatar to provide financial support for Hamas's organization. Why? Because it wanted to keep the Palestinians divided. So in Netanyahu's mind, the key strategic objective is to prevent Palestinian unification and any prospect of a Palestinian state. And I think this step is an attempt to prevent Mr. Netanyahu changing the situation on the ground before most countries have expressed their position.
And why haven't Foreign Minister Winston Peters and the New Zealand government announced their position?
I think for several reasons. I think it's domestic politics. This is a coalition government. And it's no secret that David Seymour has a position that's probably much more pro-Israeli than either Mr. Peters, the foreign minister, or Mr. Luxon, the prime minister. By keeping this decision under wraps, although Seymour has spoken out about it, by keeping this decision under wraps, it avoids opening up what could be a damaging debate within the government before they're in a position to formalise the decision. I think there's another reason here, and that concerns the United States. I think New Zealand has waiting for other liberal democracies to make their move before it wanted to announce it or go ahead. New Zealand is feeling quite vulnerable after the tariffs that we received from the United States, 10% tariff, and then that was boosted to a 15% tariff. There's little doubt that the Trump administration will not be pleased by these moves. And I think from the government's point of view, one of the advantages of keeping any decision under wraps until the last moment is that it prevents the United States expressing its public displeasure. And if the Trump administration did criticize the coalition government, that could cause a crisis within the coalition government, given Mr. Seymour's position. Also, Miss New Zealand's first position is much more ambiguous on the Palestinian issue. Some of the supporters of the New Zealand First and ACT may well be Trump sympathizers. In short, by keeping this decision under wraps to next week, or this week, I should say, and not stating a position up front, from the coalition government's point of view, it makes things a lot more orderly and prevents a debilitating debate before a decision is made.
And what sort of answer should we see or should we expect to see from this government?
Well, I think this is belated. I think New Zealand, let's be quite clear, the crisis in Gaza goes to the heart of our identity. This country was founded in the Treaty of Waitangi, which was cooperation between the indigenous people and the European settlers. And while we haven't always implemented the treaty as fully as we probably could, nevertheless, that is the vision and the aspirations behind it. And that translates into our vision of how the world should be organized. We want to see a world based on rules, principles, and international law. What we're witnessing in Gaza was, first of all, a war crime by Hamas, which initiated this round of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis didn't begin on the 7th of October 2023. It seems to me that this situation is that we could have, our position has been somewhat ambiguous. In the UN, we were the first country amongst the Five Eyes to support a ceasefire. At the same time, we didn't hesitate to cooperate with Washington in dealing, helping to sort of contain the consequences of this crisis. We, for example, sent six Defense Force personnel to try to contain or try to counter, I should say, the illegal activities of the Houthi rebels. But the Houthi rebels were only began their campaign against civilian shipping, and that's not condoning it, but they only began it 6 weeks after the Gaza crisis, and they indicated would there be a ceasefire in Gaza, they would end their campaign immediately. So we've been a bit ambiguous. On the one hand, supporting a two-state solution, supporting an immediate ceasefire. On the other hand, not really vocalizing that or articulating that much outside the UN. And it seems to me that we could have been leading on this issue at a much earlier stage. It's Spain and Ireland amongst the Western countries that have taken up the lead. Let's be quite clear about this. It's not in New Zealand's interest for international law to be trashed. Our country critically depends on what's called a rules-based order. It may be an inconvenience for great powers, but for us, it's the way it sets the framework in which New Zealand protects its, both its trade interests and also its security interests. So we have a lot at stake, both in what's happening in Gaza and also in the Ukraine. But it seems to me that given our core national interests are at stake, I would have thought the government could have been a bit more robust earlier.
That was the University of Otago's Robert Patman on international support for Palestinian statehood in the midst of the ongoing UN session and what we can expect from Foreign Minister Winston Peters.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Thick black mascara and little black curtains. Two little holes in my neck that was bitten. Black velvet capes with stylish bat wings. These are a few of my favourite things.
It's the sound of music, but not as you know it. The 95BFM Monday 1 to 4 with the sinister sister and goth mother superior, Penny Black. Tune in to hear our dark diva spinning nothing but the unholy best from the Devil's Discotheque. Brought to you by Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahape Road.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday only on 95BFM. Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
That song there was The One by The Empty Threats, and before that was Thursday by Osobi Seksu. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire here on 95BFM.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
The government has passed with urgency a temporary halt on some international adoptions under the Adoption Amendment Bill. The urgency of this bill is aimed at combating the exploitation of young children who have been adopted from overseas. I spoke to Children's Commissioner, Dr. Claire Ahmed, about this temporary pause and what this will mean for some children overseas awaiting adoption. Currently, what is the process for adopting a child overseas? Is it a rigorous process?
So in New Zealand, we have a law that governs our adoptions, and that is the Adoption Act 1955. So that's quite an old law, right? And it is very much in need of reform. We also are what's called a states party to the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption, which is an international private law agreement between countries that governs how intercountry adoption, so adoption across borders of children, happens. But there are some countries that sit outside of that Hague Convention. And under Section 17 of our Adoption Act 1955, in some instances, the New Zealand courts will recognise adoptions that occur in courts overseas. And so that's essentially what this law reform passed by the government under urgency last week has been focusing on, addressing some of the harms to children that have been allowed to occur under that Section 17 recognition of overseas adoptions.
Are these harms of children under, like you said, Section 17 of the Adoption Act 1955 quite prolific here in Aotearoa?
So I understand that around 1,000 children a year on recent years have been adopted in a way that is recognised under Section 17. And I understand that the majority of those children have been adopted in Samoa. So we're looking at around 1,000 children on average a year, and the majority from Samoa.
Now, this is a temporary pause. Has the government indicated how long this pause will be for?
I understand that, as you say, yes, this is a temporary pause. In order to actually undertake some further work to get things right to make sure that safeguards are in place. And I understand that the temporary pause is in place until the 1st of July next year, as I understand it. And we need to recognise here, I think, what has been happening for some of these children in these adoption situations has been some very, very severe and significant abuse of children that has been well documented through the media. And I'm talking about physical abuse, sexual abuse of children and exploitation akin to modern slavery.
And if we're looking at Section 17 of the Adoption Act 1955, which, as we've discussed, allows for adoptions from countries outside of the Hague Convention system, which safeguards children, why do we or have we allowed adoptions from outside of the system?
Well, I think that has been essentially is something that Section 17 has allowed under our Adoption Act 1955. And so I think what it shows is how out of date this piece of legislation is. We know that harm has been going on, and I really think that a move to address this has been a long time coming. And so that's why, as Children's Commissioner, I actually welcome this temporary pause. I think it's important to ensure that harm is prevented, because we are talking about preventable harm to children here. I would have preferred that it didn't, it wasn't rushed through the House like it was under urgency. However, it is the right thing to be doing at this point in time, to actually put in place a safeguard to prevent more harm from occurring to children in these situations.
You've mentioned Samoa. What other countries will this temporary ban on international adoptions impact?
Look, I don't have that full list in front of me, but as I mentioned, I understand that out of the around 1,000 children adopted every year recognised under Section 17, the majority have been from Samoa.
What does this mean for children overseas who were unable to make a visa application prior to last week's law change? Does this not put them in a vulnerable situation?
Look, there will be some families and children who are left in a bit of a grey zone now. However, I understand that built into this law reform is the provision for exceptional circumstances to be recognised. So I think it's important that we recognise that there is that exceptional circumstances provision that is baked into this law reform, which is important.
You mentioned previously, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this temporary pause will be until July next year. Isn't this quite a long time?
Well, I understand that at the same time now, there is work going on across agencies, across government agencies, to actually come to a longer-term solution. And I note that the minister in charge of this bill, Minister McKee, in charge of this law change, she was very clear that the proposed long-term approach, that will actually come forward into the legislative process next year. She's mentioned that there will be an opportunity for people to have a say on that at Select Committee, and that's really important because we do need to ensure that there is a enduring long-term solution here that's going to continue to prevent harm and that's going to actually take a children's rights approach and balance all those different rights of children that may be engaged in these situations. That's very important, and that it will be something that I will be advocating for through this continued work.
Now, you touched on a little bit of my last question there regarding Nicole McKee intending to implement a longer-term legislation to Parliament next year. What do you hope is in this legislation to guarantee the protection of children, but also to solidify parents' trust in the adoption, in the international adoption system?
Well, I'll be engaging in discussions with the relevant government agencies that are working on this piece of work over the coming months. And what I will be advocating for there is a really clear children's rights approach. And what that means is that I will be looking at all of the children's rights that are engaged under the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. I'll be looking to ensure that the process is balancing those rights, and that ultimately the long-term solution here takes an approach that is going to uphold children's rights, ensure their best interests and safety, and prevent any future abuses and harm from occurring for children in these kinds of situations.
That was Children's Commissioner Dr. Claire Ahmed about the recent pause on overseas adoptions.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
say, claim another farm in which a genius comes. Yeah, baby, come on, get your high heels on. It's a body is cold, it's a course is run. What madness, living loss of pain thrills. What calamities usher all that brilliance to the hills. Can you feel it? We'll be right back.
down, hit the ground so hard. Found this thing thrown out on the water. He sees these things on his computer screens. He sees these things that we would never see.
That was Limousine by Parley, Taxes by Geese, and Roman Holiday by Fontaines DC. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
I know you must have another question, so I'll shut up.
The Wire.
Last week, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices met to review childhood vaccination recommendations in the US. The committee, whose members were appointed by anti-vaccination U.S. Secretary of Health, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., have voted on a variety of recommendations for child vaccinations and restrictions of vaccinations from COVID-19 to measles and mumps. This move has been met with concern, both over the implications for the health and well-being of the children and the public, and what it means for one of the most prominent countries and advisory boards to make such a move. I spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, Helen Patousis-Harris, about the confused and muddled recommendations, what they mean for public health, and what this says about the state of vaccine regulation. For starters, what sort of recommendation changes were the committee looking at?
Well, I actually must say I find it amusing to see that some of them didn't actually know what they were voting for. And that's actually added to the confusion. So I think the key things that have come out have been in regard to the discussions around hepatitis B vaccine and also the measles, mumps, and measles, mumps, rubella and chickenpox vaccine and where and how that is used.
What decisions did the committee make?
Well, they're very confusing. With regard to the measles, mumps, rubella and chickenpox, previously they had available an option where people could get the vaccine given as a single vaccine. So for the four diseases, measles, mumps, rubella and chickenpox. Now they have said you can't have that vaccine, you have to have them separately, which means that parents don't have the choice. So while they wanted parents to have more choices, that is that to change. So it's also very confusing because, and I find it confusing too, because of course over in the United States, people have health insurance and things like that that cover the cost of their vaccines. They don't have a system like we do. So the problem is if something's not recommended, it means that it might not be covered by their insurance. And then of course there's different insurance providers and things like that. So it gets very, very complicated. And what's actually happened is, and this is why I find it difficult to give you a straight answer, everybody is confused. So they also want to remove giving the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. And there they give it at birth. Here we do it for mothers. A baby's born to mothers who are hepatitis B positive. It's a discussion that we've had here before, whether we offer a routine birth dose. The issue there is they don't pick up the hepatitis B mothers well enough to be able to prevent that. So, because that's an infection that can get passed from the mother to the baby. So it's all over the map, I have to say.
Well, you've mentioned it a bunch there, and you've called it muddled. What does it mean that the CDC's advisory committee is a point of confusion, is a point of just being completely unclear?
Well, first of all, it's now stacked with sort of political appointees, not actually career experts in the field. First of all, they don't actually understand what the committee they're on does and how it works, right? So there's that confusion to start with. They're not familiar with the topic, the infectious diseases and vaccines topic. So when they're asked to discuss these policies, they're not in any way equipped to do that. And of course, they're also discussing them without the benefit of robust science. While there is some in there, and I looked at the presentations, there's some in there, and some of it's just completely sort of crazy. So again, adding more and more layers of confusion, if you like.
And with this politicisation, I guess, of the committees, are we likely to see any trends maybe globally or outside of the US, or is this something that's just going to continue to develop within that country?
I think probably mixed. I think, of course, everybody is watching watching what's happening there. And this is, for example, a group that have really been leaders in the world. So it weakens some of the really super advice and science that we've traditionally looked to. So we've got to kind of, we can't look in that direction anymore for some of their wisdom, I guess, if you like. But I think the biggest risk at the moment is that that spread of and that weaponization of this topic, and that spreads more than any virus. Of course, the spread of the information is instant and it's wide, and that's something we're not well equipped to deal with, I think. And also, of course, it is, I was going to say unprecedented, but I think we've had enough practice now through at least the pandemic. But that would be a big concern, that the messages are becoming more and more confusing. So it must be very difficult if you're a parent and you sort of want to do a little Google search on vaccines or something for your child, and what you might be, you know, what the searches might be returning could be extremely confusing.
And of course, are there any real concerns about vaccinations?
They haven't presented any new science whatsoever. So there are no new concerns about about vaccines whatsoever. This is purely, and I think it's important perhaps to reiterate this, this is purely political. This is purely personal agendas, not, it's got nothing to do with science and evidence-based policies or anything like that.
And finally, what sort of public health impacts are we likely to see based on these personal agendas?
I think it's going to, public health impact in the US is going to be massive. It's further eroding the trust. And now you've got this whole new generation of young people who 10 years ago were too young to be looking and being interested in the space. And now they're starting, you know, they're having kids, they're looking into this, and that they know nothing else but this chaos. They're going to see with the making it more difficult to get vaccines and making these very ambiguous recommendations means that the vaccine rates are, well, they're already trending down, they're going to go down. People's confidence has been eroded. They're already seeing resurgence of disease there already. So in terms of the public health impact, it's going to be massive. Also, a lot of the insurance companies won't be paying for the vaccines by the look of it. Again, that's confusing. But here, again, erosion of any trust, I guess, and confidence in vaccines, that's going to just make things much harder because information, of course, doesn't have borders, if you like. Also, the risk of importing these infectious diseases from the US becomes a greater risk. It's all a bit of a disaster, really.
That was the University of Auckland's Helen Patousis-Harris on the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunisation Practices' review of vaccine recommendations and regulations.
Oh, yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korido mai ki maua mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Auckland's, the University of Otago's Robert Patman, Children's Commissioner Dr. Claire Ahmed, and the University of Auckland's Helen Patousis-Harris. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.